Good afternoon, everyone. We've been a little sick in our family as well, but I think we're all mostly better. We're definitely feeling better. So as most of you know, we recently had an opportunity to travel over to Asia. We got to take a trip where we went to China and Japan. And traveling over there can be very expensive, but I had to go for work. And so I wanted to take Crystal and Jarek as well, since we'd basically just have to pay for a plane ticket for each of them and food and help out with the cost a lot. So we were all able to go, and it was really quite an experience. None of us has ever been over to Asia before, and it's a very interesting part of the world. I love traveling and seeing other cultures and societies anyway, but especially over in Asia, it's very different than the US and Europe and the Western cultures that we're used to. There's differences in the way that they interact with each other. There's differences in what they eat. They eat a lot of interesting things. The languages are very different. In both Chinese and Japanese, they have a concept of tones, which is basically like the pitch that you say a sound at. And so in English, if you say hello, you know, it all means the same thing. But over there, the tones actually change the meaning of the syllable, so it can be very hard to communicate. And we picked up a couple of books to try to learn enough Chinese and Japanese so that we could make our way back to the hotel if we got lost, or, you know, ask for help in an emergency. And in one of these books on Chinese, they have this, it's kind of a Chinese tongue twister, that it's an example of the importance of tones. M-A is one of the sounds, and depending on how you say it, it can either mean mother or horse or scold. And so they have this tongue twister that goes ma ma chi ma ma man ma 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 ma. And what that means in English is mother rides a horse, the horse is slow, mother scolds the horse. But it sounds like you're just saying ma repeatedly. So, you know, language was something that was very different and really interesting to learn about. They also have very different words that they say depending on the person that you're talking to. So if you're talking with someone who's more important than you, or at the same level of importance as you, or less important than you, then you might have a completely different set of words that you say in how you say hello or thank you or all of those different common phrases. And so, you know, we were able to pick some of that up, and it was definitely an experience. They don't have phonetic alphabets like most Roman languages, so they have characters that actually mean words or concepts or phrases. And so there's not an alphabet that you can memorize and then go and start to pick words out. You have to learn all these characters. And that was really difficult at first, but then we started to recognize some of the characters. Especially, we took a trip over the weekend where we went and we were in Tokyo, and we left and kept the Sabbath down south of there in Osaka and Awaji Island, which is this really beautiful area. All of the trees were changing colors, and it was just gorgeous. But when we went down there, there were fewer English speakers and fewer English signs. In Tokyo, everything is pretty much in kanji and then also in an English version of the Japanese names. But when we went down south, it wasn't that way. And so we started to recognize some of the names. And what we do is we would look at the characters and try to pick out from the characters something that we could recognize. Like Awaji Island, the first character of the name of Awaji Island, it looked like trees, like two little pine trees. And so we would look for that on all the signs, and okay, this is our stop. This is where we need to get off the bus. But it was just something that was vastly different from the other travel that we've done, where they've spoken French or Spanish or English. So that was a lot of fun. The other thing that's really different over there, when we went to China, we went to Beijing. And Beijing is a very modern city, especially the area that we were in. It was kind of a business district. And so it was lots of big skyscrapers that have been built in just the last few years. It's all steel and glass and water fountains and cars everywhere. And it's very, very dense. And same thing in Japan. It's very, very dense. They have just so many people there crammed into such a small space that it's a very different way of construction and living than what we're used to here in Texas, where we have lots of wide open spaces. In Beijing, the pollution was horrible. It was worst pollution I've ever seen. On some of the days, you would go outside and you wouldn't be able to see any more than half a mile, probably not even half a mile. And so, you know, you'd look down the street and it would just fade into orange. And it was a very bitter, caustic kind of smell and taste. And you really couldn't breathe it too long before you started to have watery eyes and a sore throat. It was just very harsh. And there are 22 million people who live in that all the time. It's pretty incredible. And Beijing is the second largest city in the world behind Mexico City, but they actually are hoping to pass Mexico City and become the largest city in the world. I don't know why that's a goal to shoot for, really, but that's one of the things that they want to do. And they have these loops that are built around the city, like our bypasses that we have in Dallas and Houston and San Antonio, and they call them ring roads, and they have six ring roads. So if you think about, you go to San Antonio and there's 410 and 1604, and then you have six of those going out, and they're actually building four more. So by the time they're done, they're going to have 10 loops around the city, and it's just going to be this massive city. They do everything at a huge scale over there. The construction is a really hot market in China right now, especially in Shanghai and Beijing. And a lot of people are saying that it's a bubble like what we were having here in the U.S. a few years ago, because they're just building so many condos and houses in these cities, and it's far more than what are actually needed. We passed a construction site at one point where they were putting up a complex of apartments, but all of these apartment buildings were basically high-rise, 25, 30-story buildings. And it wasn't just that they were building one or two of these. You might see that in a U.S. city where they build a couple of towers, and they call them, you know, the towers at Town Lake. I think there was a construction in Austin that they did like that. There were probably 15 to 20 of these skyscraper apartment complexes that they were building. So, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of apartments going up just in this one section. They just do it on such a large scale. And when you think about the size of China, if you try to find out what the population is, they say it's between 1.2 and 1.5 billion people. They have a rounding error of 300 million people, which is just about the population of the U.S. So it's completely different scale and scope in terms of how they build things and how they have to handle their society and their population over there. China is the world's largest country. They have the largest population of English speakers. And as they have grown and their economy has grown and there are more middle class families there, they've become the largest nation of beer drinkers. So it was interesting to see Budweiser is really trying to get a presence over there so they can capture that massive Chinese beer market. When we were over there, we talked about some of the construction work with some of the people that we were meeting with. We were talking about this high-rise apartment complex that we passed, and one of the people that we were talking with said, well, you know, they don't all have plumbing in them. And we said, well, so, you know, they're not finished. He said, no, people buy them like that. And I was trying to understand this, and so I came back and I was doing a little research, and I found an article from earlier this year in Bloomberg Business Week where they interviewed an investor. His name is Jim Kanos. He's an investor who... somebody who's been saying that he thinks there's going to be a property and real estate bubble that's going to pop at some point in China. And this was a quote from this Bloomberg Businessweek interview with him on April 8th of this year. He said, the perception seems to be that China will grow out of this situation, but the problem with that argument is the real estate being built is not for the masses. This is not affordable housing for the middle class. This is high-end condos in major urban areas and high-end office buildings. Just to give you an idea, right now, construction costs in China are starting to hit $100 to $150 per square foot in some cities. That doesn't sound like a lot by Western standards, but it means a condominium basically presented to you with no floors, no walls, no appliances, costs the average Chinese two-income couple $100,000 to $150,000 U.S. That Chinese two-income couple in their 30s usually makes a combined $7,000 or $8,000 a year. Part of how they make this housing more affordable is they don't finish it out. And so you buy a condo or an apartment in one of these buildings, and it doesn't have the walls, it doesn't have plumbing fixtures, it's roughed out where it just has the pipe comes up to your floor, and basically, you know, once you buy it, you then have to finish out the house. But they make it like that so that people can afford to get into these places with the idea that they get into it now and it'll appreciate in cost and they can get a home equity loan and build it out. And it's very similar to what was going on here. He continues, he says, you do the math. Even if they were making $10,000 to $15,000 a year, they couldn't carry a $150,000 condo. This is very similar to someone making $40,000 in the U.S. at the height of our bubble, buying a $600,000 or $800,000 house, and we all know how that ended. So it's very different in some ways. but then also very similar in some ways as well. The size of the companies over there can be staggering. We met with some businesses over there. We met with three or four in China and then quite a few in Japan. But in China, one of the companies we met with had 200,000 employees. And that was the smallest business that we met with. The largest one had 650,000. So it's just, again, just incredible. It's a completely different scale for everything that they're doing over there. But, you know, China has been a rising power. Earlier this year, they passed Japan as the world's second largest economy. It's been the U.S. number one, Japan number two for years and years and years. And I think it was in August of this year, China passed Japan and is now the number two economy. But they don't just want to be number two in terms of GDP or income or anything like that. They're determined to reclaim what they feel is their rightful spot as a world superpower and as a respected power in the world. And so they have these very big ambitions that they intend to carry out. I remember a few years ago, I heard a report on the radio and I went and looked it up. It was in 2005. There was a report that a couple of reporters who had gone to China for about a month and talked with a bunch of business leaders there. And one of the big goals that there's a central economic planning committee that kind of directs all industry and economy in the entire country. Since it is a communist country, the government owns at least in part every company that's there and has a right to direct its output and its direction and what it does with its profits. And one of the decisions that they had made is that in 5 years, they wanted to have 50 global brands. None of the top 100 brands were Chinese brands. So they started buying Maytag and they bought ThinkPad from IBM and several other big brands like this. And they started to create some of their own, like Pearl River, who makes more pianos than anyone else in the world. And they have a car company that makes an electric car that hasn't really made it here in the U.S., but is used elsewhere in the world. So they're really trying to drive towards these lofty goals. They set that as a five-year goal 5 years ago. And when the brand report came out this year for the top 100 global brands, still none of them were Chinese. So they hadn't hit that, but they said that's because of the economy. And they've given themselves till 2020 now to meet that. But one of the people that we met with over there said that the big focus now from the Central Planning Committee is that they want to take China from being an industrial society to an information society. So they're putting a lot of money into computers and technology and software development to try to take on Microsoft and Google and Oracle and the companies at the top of the information industry. It was just really interesting to go over there and see it firsthand and see how they live. See how it works over there. If you want to do business in China, you can't just go incorporate a company and start doing business like you can in most Western nations. You have to have some sort of a partnership with the government and with an existing company. So it's much more difficult to get in over there. But, you know, it's also a huge market. And so that's why so many companies are willing to go through the difficulties and take the hit to their profits at some level because it's just such a massive market. After China, we went to Japan, and we were in Japan for about a week. And Japan was similar to China in some respects, but also very different. The cultures were similar. There's a lot of respect and hierarchy in both of the cultures. But in Japan, it wasn't just that when you were in the city, it was very modern and up-to-date. Everywhere that we went in Japan was very modern. And when we traveled down south over the weekend, we took one of their bullet trains and we traveled, I think it was about 400 miles south. And the entire time, it was almost like you were in one big city. There were skyscrapers and large buildings outside the whole time. It was much more dense than China. They just have a small island, but still a very large population. And they try to make use of every piece of land they have. When they build their cities, they really love parks. So they always have parks and trees and green spaces everywhere. But then when they build a building, it's very tall. Underneath the cities, they go down 10 stories with subways and trains and the plumbing, and the water and the sewer and everything. So it's one of those things kind of like a tree where you see a Japanese city and there's almost as much below the ground as above the ground. And then wherever there is an empty lot or something that maybe hasn't been built up yet, they'll grow something there. You know, a lot of rice, they grow rice, or, you know, they might just have a little garden there that just makes the area beautiful. but it was very modern. Sometimes it felt a little bit like traveling into the future. They love technology over there. They all have phones that are quite a ways ahead of the phones that we have here. And we think of the iPhone and some of the new Android phones as being really advanced. They had phones that were, they looked like something out of the future. And their toilets there are incredibly advanced. It was really funny. People had told me before I went over there, oh, well, you know, you're going to be amazed at the toilets. It's kind of like, what are you talking about? Amazed at the toilets. But the toilets are equipped with all of these electronics. They have automatic flushers and things like that that we're used to, but they're also heated, and they have automatic deodorizers on them. They have built-in bidets. They have air dryers. They have just this crazy array of electronics in the toilets, and then a remote control to control it all. And it's funny because, you know, it wasn't just the toilets in the hotels we stayed at. You'd go to a restaurant or you'd stop in at something that's just Starbucks or something like that. And they have the same kinds of toilets there everywhere. I started noticing that every toilet that I saw was made by this Japanese company, Toto, T-O-T-O. And I think that they have a monopoly because no one else in the world can match the standards that are required for Japanese toilets. It was funny. They have obviously put a lot of effort and engineering and innovation into the bathroom. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what we saw there. But after we spent a week there, we came back to the airport and we're heading on our way home, and we were sitting in the airport waiting to board our airplane, and the first news report started to come in from the North Korean attack on the South Korean island in the disputed border area. And we were all thinking, looks like we're getting out of here at about the right time. We were happy to be going home. And we got home. We were really jet lagged. We got home just before Thanksgiving, and our schedules were all off. On Thanksgiving Day, the phone rang, and we were all sleeping, and I finally kind of got out of bed and stumbled over to the phone and didn't get there in time, but it was my mom calling to see if we were coming over, and it was about 1 or 1:30 in the afternoon. We had just slept right through Thanksgiving because our schedules were so off. But in spite of that and all the time it's taken us to get readjusted, we are very grateful to be back in the U.S., and it really got me to thinking about gratitude and thankfulness. And that's what I want to talk about today, is how can we express gratitude and thankfulness? China is one of the most rapidly advancing countries in the world. Japan has been an advanced nation for decades. And in Japan, there are all sorts of high-tech luxuries. It's a very modern society. But, you know, when we came back, we were really grateful to be back here in the U.S. And we were really thankful for all of the opportunities that we have in the U.S. So it got me to thinking about some things related to thankfulness and gratitude. And I started thinking, am I really thankful? You know, I feel thankful right now, but am I really thankful on a regular basis? Does it take something this dramatic to actually make me feel thankful? I also asked the question, you know, what's wrong with being ungrateful? Because I'm sure at some point in our life, we've all been ungrateful. Maybe unconsciously, we haven't been grateful when we should have. But what's wrong with that? You know, is there a problem with that? If we look in the Bible, we'll see that there definitely is. Let's turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. We read these verses fairly regularly. And here at the beginning of 2 Timothy chapter 3, it talks about the end times and how it's going to be. But there's one attribute in here that I wonder if sometimes we gloss over. Because in comparison to the others, it might seem like a lesser evil, a lesser negative attitude. Let's just read here in 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful. They're ungrateful. Unholy, verse 3, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent or without self-control, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof. And then here at the end of verse 5, from such turn away. So anyone who exhibits these traits is someone that we should turn away from. We shouldn't associate with them. We shouldn't be like them. We shouldn't imitate them. It's an attitude that is undesirable and not Christian. And you look at this, and one of the ones that's listed in there is unthankful. So we see that it's not something that we should practice. It's not an attribute that should be identified with us. But why is that? What's wrong with being unthankful? Being unthankful is really a negative attitude. It's an unchristian attitude. We know that a true Christian attitude is an attitude of love, of give, of service, of outgoing concern. And the opposite of that is selfishness, pride, vanity. And if you think about what leads to an unthankful attitude versus a thankful attitude, if you're unthankful, then you are being greedy. You're not happy with what you have. You're probably vain. You think you deserve better. All of these kinds of things lead to that. One of the questions that I want to ask is, do you have a hard time thinking of things to be thankful for? We really live in a country that's blessed above other countries. And so it shouldn't be that hard for us to think of things to be thankful for. If it is, then we need to examine ourselves and make sure that we're not getting into a bad attitude. Let's turn over to James chapter 4. James chapter 4 and verse 2. We think again about why is it wrong to be ungrateful or to be unthankful. James 4 verse 2, you lust and have not, you kill and desire to have and cannot obtain, you fight and war, yet you have not because you ask not. Verse 3, you ask and receive not because you ask amiss that you may consume it upon your lusts. If you are lusting, if you're killing, desiring to have, and you have this kind of greed and this selfish get attitude, then you're definitely not thankful for the things that you have. If you were thankful, if you had a feeling of gratitude and of being blessed, then you wouldn't have these attitudes of lust and greed and selfishness that were leading you to fight and war. And it says here, kill. It really goes right along with the give and the get way of life. If you have the give attitude, if you want to share and give, you're going to be thankful for the things that you have because you're going to see them as the result of being blessed, of having things given to you. If you have the get attitude, when you get things, you see it as, oh, well, I deserve it. You know, it's coming to me because I should have it, you know, rather than it's coming to me and it's a blessing and I should be thankful for it. Let's turn back to 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 1. This is Paul writing to Timothy here. He says, I exhort, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. And so, again, you know, this is a verse that we're familiar with. Supplications, prayers, intercessions, but also giving of thanks be made for all men. Verse 2, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. And I'm sure that we've read this before and we thought in the context of, yes, we need to pray for our leaders. But here it actually says that we should be giving thanks too. And while this country has its ups and downs and has strong leaders and weak leaders and in-between leaders, we should still be thankful that we live in a country where we have freedom to practice our religion. And over in China, it's not something that they have. The leadership there doesn't allow the citizens of their country to do that. And here, at least, we do have a country and we historically have had a leadership that has protected that right, even though, you know, maybe they don't respect the authority of God, they don't respect the authority of the Bible, and they try to minimize it and push it out of public life. The fact is still that we're able to study, to pray, to get together and have church services, to get together for the holy days, and it's really a blessing and something that we can give thanks for. And, you know, it says here, for all men. As we go through these verses, you'll see that there's no excuse given for being unthankful. It doesn't matter if you have a bad boss, if you've had a bad week, if your car broke down. There are a lot of places where in the Bible it says that we are to give thanks always. We are to give thanks in everything. We are to be thankful for everything. Here it says giving thanks for all men. This is the other part of the attitude. If we are in this kind of a mindset, we're going to be looking for the positive. We're going to be looking for the things that are blessings, the things where we can see that it is being worked out for us, versus looking at it the negative way and thinking of, oh, you know, look at all these things that went wrong and all these horrible things that are happening to me and getting into kind of a bad attitude. One other verse about unthankfulness. Let's turn over to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. And verse 18, Romans 1, verse 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it unto them." There's no excuse for anyone to not be able to have the knowledge of God, to know that he exists. Verse 20, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made." So it's saying that the things that you can't see, you can understand by the things which we can see. We can't see God, we can't see the angels, but we can know they're there by what the Bible says, by observing the creation around us. And so by that, we can know that it exists. Verse 20, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that, when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. When David looked up and saw the stars, he was thankful." He said, "What is man that you are mindful of him?" He was thankful that God cares, that he gives us the time of day, so to speak, that he is willing to be a part of our lives and be involved in our lives. And so many scientists, they look at that and they figure out how to remove God from it completely. There was a story this week that astrophysicists have discovered that they may have made some fundamental mistakes in the way that they calculated the number of stars in the universe. They calculated the number of stars in the universe based off of a ratio of dimmer stars to stars that are like our sun. And they had a fixed ratio, and they applied that to how many of the brighter stars they could see. But what they discovered is that in other galaxies that aren't like the Milky Way galaxy, that the ratio could be vastly different. It could be 100 times different. And so there could be many, many more stars. And they think, one particular researcher thinks, that there are probably 3 times as many stars out there as what scientists previously thought. So I want you to write a number down in your notes here, if you're taking notes. I want you to write 3. So write the number 3, and then write 23 zeros after that. So 3 and then 23 zeros. That number is 300 sextillion. And that is how many stars they think are out there now. And that's a number that's too big to comprehend. When you write it out and you see all those zeros, I have it right here, it's a lot of zeros. And like we always say, what's that out there for? But when they see that, they don't see that and go, wow, how could that all have just ended up like that? They see that and they go, well, this changes some of our theories and this changes some of the fundamental ways that we were calculating and explaining the universe before. But, you know, that's okay. We'll just go back and start to rework it from this point and figure it all out again, rather than thinking that it was created, that it was put into place, that it operates off of a system of laws that were created. This is what Paul is talking about here in Romans. And it says that they weren't thankful. If you were truly thankful, it leads to humility. Because when you're truly thankful, what you're doing is you're acknowledging that you have gotten something that you aren't solely responsible for. You didn't earn it all. You didn't make it happen through your strength or your greatness. You know, if you were really thankful and grateful for something, you're acknowledging that someone else has given you something, has given you a gift or an opportunity, and it's the opposite of taking something for granted, and it leads to an attitude of humility. Because you can't feel gratitude like that without feeling a little bit humbled that whatever it might be, you got a gift or that God has called you to his truth, all of those things make you feel less self-sufficient. So that's some of what's wrong with being ungrateful. And you can go through and you can study, and there are lots of commands to give thanks, to be grateful, to express gratitude. And so it's a very interesting study. But for the rest of services, what I want to talk about is specifically 4 ways that we can express and act on thankfulness. And what does it mean to be thankful? Thankfulness, it's an attitude and a feeling. It's an emotion. You have a feeling of gratitude. You know, you are grateful, you're happy, you're joyful. You might be emotionally moved because of something that you appreciate. But it's a completely positive emotion and attitude. Beyond that, though, how do you express it? Are there actions that we can take? Is there something that you can do as a follow-on when you're thankful? I want to talk about four ways that we can express and act on thankfulness. So the first one is very simple. It's just to say thank you. Communicate our gratefulness. And it sounds like a very obvious one, but think about how many times somebody has done something for you and you've thought, oh, that was nice. But then you didn't go back and you didn't say, I really appreciate that. Thank you. That was really nice. A lot of times we might think that, but we don't always express it. There's an example over in Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17 and verse 11. This involves Jesus Christ here. Luke 17 verse 11. And it came to pass as he went to Jerusalem that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. It's talking about Christ. And as he entered into a certain village, there met him 10 men that were lepers, which stood afar off. So there were 10 men here that all were suffering from leprosy. And they lifted up their voices and said, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. Verse 14. And when he saw them, he said unto them, Go show yourselves unto the priests. And it came to pass that as they went, they were cleansed. So Jesus had said, Go show yourself to the priests, which was kind of the last step of the process. If you had leprosy and you were cleansed and you wanted to be brought back into the congregation. And so as they went, they were cleansed. Verse 15, And one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back and with a loud voice glorified God. Verse 16, And fell down on his face at his feet, giving him thanks. And he was a Samaritan. Verse 17, And Jesus answering said, Were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? There are not found that return to give glory to God save this stranger. So in this case, there were 10 men who all had leprosy, a horrible disease. They were cleansed of it, and only one of them took the time to come back and say thanks, give glory to God. And maybe the other ones were not paying attention. Maybe they were so excited that they had been healed of this horrible disease. Who knows what happened, but they should have taken the time and they should have thought, oh, well, you know, I need to go give thanks for this. Think about in our life, how often do we do that? Do we just let it slip our mind and we don't actually say thank you? And it could be just saying it in person. You can just make a call. You can send an email. I think that you can send a handwritten note. And I think that's something that actually can be very special because so often we don't write. We don't actually handwrite out letters and notes or anything these days. And so you handwrite a note and a thank you card or something and send it to somebody. It's special. I know we've gotten a couple of those and we always open them up and we read them and it's special. It means something. When we were in Japan, one of the things that was very noteworthy was there was a much higher degree of formality there than what we have here in the U.S. and just overall a general respect among people for each other. In some cases, it maybe went too far. There was a lot of just very extreme deference in terms of hierarchies, like in companies. Some of the employees were literally terrified of their bosses. It was interesting because the way that some of these meetings went, we had more junior employees who were working with us on technology and who were now in these meetings with senior employees from their company, vice presidents and senior vice presidents and general managers. And these were very high up in the hierarchy people, and some of these junior employees had never talked to these people before, and they would get real nervous when they were around them. If they were asked a question or were supposed to present, they would almost not be able to talk because there's this real strict hierarchy. But besides that, in general, there was just a more noticeable respect towards each other. There was a lot more politeness. There was a lot of hospitality. There was thoughtfulness from everyone over there. One of the things that we picked up on pretty quickly is that when you're in an elevator, you don't talk, especially in the dense city of Tokyo, the elevators get very packed. And if you're on a cell phone call, you either end the call or you don't get in the elevator. And once everybody was in the elevator, if it was a mixed group of people, then you didn't talk. It was just, you know, you and some other people that you knew, you might be talking. But as the elevators got packed, it was just quiet. And one of the really striking things that happened is we went to this very busy shopping district that's kind of like Times Square in New York. And there are people bustling everywhere. It's one of those things where the crosswalk turns green and you just have this crowd of people that is 15 or 20 wide stream across the street coming from the other direction. It's just people going everywhere. And we've been to New York and we've been to Times Square in that kind of situation. You better hold on to your kids and and put your shoulder down and try to make it through. But over there in Tokyo, no one touched anyone else. It was incredible. It was just as many people. Everybody was hurrying just as much, but everybody was just more aware. You didn't have people who were talking on their phone or playing a video game, just kind of running into each other. It was something where they were just aware of where everyone else was, and nobody ran into each other. The train that we took, we didn't buy tickets in time to get a reserved seat. So there are three cars on every train that are for unreserved seats. And it's basically, you know, you show up there and you hope you can get a seat. If you can't, then you go and you catch the next train that's going to your destination. And you can imagine what that would be like in a U.S. city. It would be like a rugby match. When the doors open and everybody rushes to try to get the seats and shoving and pushing, and it doesn't matter if you've got a cane or, you know, if you're 80 years old, I'm going to get to that seat. The way that they did it there is they actually had lines painted on the floor that went from the door in different directions. And so everyone just lined up at the door and they followed the line and they built these long lines. And when the doors opened, you went on the train. And when there were no more seats, then people stopped getting on the train and they started over to wherever the next train was going to be and they lined up there. And it was funny because we did see a couple of people who cut in line, but nobody made a big deal out of it. Out of the hundreds of people, it was really only a couple of people who even tried something like that. So there is just a level of respect and concern for other people over there that was different than what we were used to over here. And one of the things that happened is after every meeting, we got a thank you note from everybody that we met with. And it's a nice little polite gesture. So that's something that we can do. We can make sure that we actually say thank you. Let's turn over to Psalms chapter 95. If you read through Psalms, you'll see that David said thank you a lot. But I thought this was interesting here in Psalms chapter 95, something that can apply to us in church services. Psalms 95 and verse 2. 95 verse 2, let us come before his presence with thanksgiving and make a joyful noise unto him with psalms. So one of the ways that we can say thank you to God the Father and Jesus Christ is by making a joyful noise when we are at church during hymn service. We can sing out and praise him and come before his presence with thanksgiving. And that's one way to say thank you. And if you study through, you'll see many, many, many cases where God's people express thankfulness in the Bible. David does it in the Psalms. David actually established two groups of Levites who had the responsibility of twice a day giving thanks. They gave songs and prayers twice a day in kind of an official capacity for the nation. And he established that when he was king. When the Jews returned from captivity back to Jerusalem, they reestablished those groups of Levites who were responsible for the thanksgiving. And at one point, they organized a, it was kind of like a Thanksgiving Day, like what we have here in the U.S. It wasn't a holy day, it was a secular day, like what we have in the U.S. and Canada. But it was a time when they were giving thanks for being able to be back in Jerusalem and be working on the temple. The apostles, you'll see that they directed Christians over and over to be thankful and to give thanks and express their gratitude. And you'll see that Paul did it a lot as well. He was thankful for the blessings that he had. He was thankful for his calling. He was thankful for the brethren. A lot of thankfulness, and they said it. So that's the first point. First way to express thankfulness is just to communicate it. Make sure that we do that and that it doesn't slip our mind. The second way to express thankfulness is to make good use of the gifts and the benefits we receive. If you think about it, think about something that you're really thankful for, you probably treasure that. You don't take it for granted. You don't just waste it. You're thankful for it, so you're going to make good use of it. You might think of something, it might be a piece of art or a piece of furniture or something that you got. If you're thankful, you're going to take care of it. You're going to put it in a nice location, and you're going to make sure that it doesn't just get torn up and ruined. You're going to make good use of it. I've mentioned about freedom of religion. That's a real blessing that we have that we can take advantage of. Things of above. Keep our eyes on the things of above instead of the things of the earth. We have the freedom to do that here. We all have Bibles. We probably all have multiple Bibles. We can own a Bible here without worrying about being caught having a Bible. So let's own a Bible and let's study it every day. Let's take advantage of that. I read another article last week that was about China, and over there they had just ordained a Catholic bishop without the agreement of the Vatican. In China, there's a state-sanctioned Catholic church. They call it the Patriotic Chinese Catholic Church. There are 10 million Catholics in China that are a part of this Patriotic Chinese Catholic Church. But the Patriotic Chinese Catholic Church doesn't accept the authority of the Pope as the head of their church. The Chinese government is the head of the Catholic Church. And so they decided that they wanted this guy to be a bishop, and the Vatican said no, and they said, you know, well, he's a bishop, and they ordained him anyway. And there are bishops over there who are affiliated and in communication with the Vatican, and the Chinese government forced all of them to go and participate in the ordination of this bishop. That's the kind of thing that can happen in other countries, and you know, it's even worse in some other countries. But we have this real blessing to live here in the U.S. or Canada or the United Kingdom, Ireland, even in South Africa, where we can participate in practicing our religion freely and openly and safely. There was a quote from someone in China about this, and he said, "For the Chinese, the appointment of a new bishop is a political act which cannot be delegated to a foreigner in Rome." So the appointment of a new bishop is a political act. It's probably a political act even when it happens in Rome, but not controlled by the communist government. That's not how it happens here. We're able to ordain deacons and elders and ministers as the leadership of the church is led to do so by Christ, the head of the church. And so, again, it's a real great blessing that we shouldn't squander. Let's turn over to Colossians chapter 2. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 1. This is Paul again. It says, "For I would that you knew what great conflict I have for you, and for them at Laodicea, and for as many as have not seen my face in the flesh, that their hearts might be comforted, being knit together in love, and unto all riches of the full assurance of understanding, to the acknowledgement of the mystery of God and of the Father and of Christ." I was thinking about this. There were churches that Paul never was able to visit, and the only way that he communicated with them was through epistles and letters, and occasionally sending a minister that he had trained there. But they didn't have CDs or DVDs. They couldn't call up Paul and talk to him. They couldn't listen to a recording of him or watch a video of him. And even that is something that we can be thankful for, that today we have a program where we can send out CDs regularly and we can hear our ministers. We can see the ministry periodically throughout the year. We can, almost all of us, gather together for the Feast of Tabernacles. And so it's something that they didn't have, that kind of a situation here in the early church. Let's drop down to verse 4. "And this I say, lest any man should beguile you with enticing words, for though I be absent in the flesh, yet am I with you in the spirit, joying and beholding your order and the steadfastness of your faith in Christ. Verse 6, as you have therefore received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk you in him, rooted and built up in him, and established in the faith as you have been taught, abounding therein with thanksgiving. Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ. For in him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily, and you are complete in him, which is the head of all principality and power." So Paul is saying here, you have the information, appreciate it, be thankful for it, and abound in it. You've been taught it. You've been established in the faith. That's what he says in verse 6 and verse 7. "As you have therefore received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk you in him, rooted and built up in him, and established in the faith, as you have been taught, abounding therein with thanksgiving." He's saying, don't get distracted. Don't get pulled off by the things of the world. Keep your eyes on the things which are above, on Christ and God and the truth that we've learned, and abound in thanksgiving in it. And that's really going to help you stay grounded and established in this truth. It's something that we should really be thankful for, and we should make sure that we don't squander it. And we have other blessings too. One of the things that was really incredible over there, especially in Japan, was the size of everyone. It's not that they're all tiny little people. There were, I think on average, probably a little shorter than we are on average here in the U.S., but there were tall men and tall women in Japan. But everyone was very petite. I don't think we saw a single obese person there, and we didn't see very many overweight people. And when we spent some time over there, we started to see that they eat a lot of fresh food. They really like fruit. They eat a lot of fruit, a lot of rice and vegetables. And they drink a lot of tea instead of soft drinks and even coffee. They mostly drink tea. And then they eat a lot of fish and less of other meat. And they have lots and lots of fish. You know, Japan is an island. So it's something where they have kind of a different diet. And what are we doing here in the U.S.? We have access to pretty much every food you can think of. And we have to remember that what we eat greatly affects our health. How we exercise greatly affects our health. And the health that we have is one of those big blessings that we don't want to waste. You know, are we taking care of our health? A lot of people in the church have a condition like diabetes or high blood pressure or high cholesterol. I have high cholesterol. When we hear something like that, what's our reaction? Do we just kind of dismiss it and then continue the way we were living? Or are we grateful for the fact that we're alive and we've found this out and we can actually do something about it? We do our part to increase our health, exercise, and eat well. It was funny because I got in an elevator at one point and there was a Japanese family. It was a man and wife, and they had a son with them who was, I think, maybe about 8. And he was overweight. He was overweight quite a bit. And he just kept talking, and they were trying to get him to be quiet and to listen, to pay attention to them. And this was towards the end of our stay there. And I was standing in the elevator. It was kind of shocking. And I realized that the reason it was so shocking is because this was the first kind of Americanized kid that I had seen over there in Japan. He was disrespectful, not listening to his parents, and overweight. And that's kind of how a lot of the children here are. But it doesn't have to be that way. It's something that we can change how we live and take advantage of that. And I think that it's something that can be hard, but, you know, it just takes self-control, just like keeping the Sabbath. It takes self-control to be able to commit that you're not going to work, that you're not going to do your pleasure, you're going to keep the Sabbath holy, or you're not going to eat pork. And so we have to make the same decision that we're going to eat the right kinds of food and in appropriate amounts, and we're going to get the right kind of exercise in appropriate amounts and take care of these blessings of health that we have. I mentioned Beijing. We don't live in a place that's like Beijing, where it hurt to breathe. On the last night we were there, the pollution was really bad, even overnight. It's not just smoggy during the day. We were in our hotel room at night, and you could just smell and taste this acrid air that was coming into the hotel room. One of the highlights for me was, even though they eat mostly fish, they do have one delicacy in Japan that's beef. It's the Kobe beef. And we changed from a train to a bus in Kobe, and we were able to go eat Kobe beef there, and it was really good. And it's very hard to get real Kobe beef that's from Japan over here. There's American Kobe-style beef, but true Kobe beef is really expensive in the U.S. I was trying to find some, and it's about $400 a pound. There's Wagyu beef that they call Kobe-style beef that you get over here, but it's generally only available in New York and Chicago and L.A. There's one place in Houston, but you have to place an order 2 weeks in advance to get it. Over there, it was quite a bit cheaper. It was very tasty. It was real moist and almost buttery. But what's interesting is that the size of the steaks are between 100 and 200 grams. So for our scientists, they can probably do that calculation pretty easily, but that's about 3 to 7 ounces. What steakhouse are you going to go to here that's going to have a 3-ounce steak, especially in Texas? You know, they're going to have the porterhouse that's 45 ounces. As we ate over there, it was really noticeable how almost all of the portions were smaller. We ate the steak, and we ate the rice and the vegetables, and it was actually a really good meal. So that's one of the things that I think we should be careful that we are making sure we don't squander our health and we don't just waste it away and end up in a bad situation prematurely in our lives because we're not taking care of ourselves. Let's turn over again to Psalms 119. Psalms 119 and verse 59. I thought on my ways and turned my feet unto your testimonies. I made haste and delayed not to keep your commandments. The bands of the wicked have robbed me, but I have not forgotten your law. Verse 62, at midnight I will rise to give thanks unto you because of your righteous judgments. You look here and you see David's attitude towards the law. He was thankful for it. And he didn't just say, yeah, you know, I'm thankful for the law. That law thing, it's pretty good. He really put it into practice. He was so grateful for it that he would wake up in the middle of the night and he would be thinking about it and he would go pray. He would pray about the law and give thanks to God because of his righteous judgments. And if you look at 59, 60, and 61, you'll see that he also put it into practice. Because again, if you're truly thankful for something, you're going to care for it. You're not just going to waste it. You waste the things that you take for granted. So he was not taking the law for granted. He was not taking that knowledge for granted. He was truly thankful for it, and it changed the way that he lived his life. So that's the second point there, is to make good use of the gifts and blessings that we have. The third thing that we can do, if we are thankful, is we can return the favor, or pay it back, so to speak. Let's turn over to Ephesians chapter 1. You know the saying, one good turn deserves another, one good deed deserves another. Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 15. Paul says, "Wherefore I also, after I heard of your faith in the Lord Jesus and love unto all the saints, cease not to give thanks for you, making mention of you in my prayers, that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of glory, may give unto you the spirit of wisdom and revelation in the knowledge of him." So here, these people were living the right way of life, and Paul was thankful for it. But what he did is he then prayed about it and asked God to give them wisdom and more understanding of knowledge. So part of his thankfulness was to ask God to bless them. And paying it back or returning the favor, it doesn't mean that if somebody does something for you, you turn around and you do the same thing for them. If somebody gives you a watch, you don't give them a watch right back. You can do something for them. There's another area where Paul talks about the help that some of the brethren had given him, and he does the same thing. His response is he prays and asks for more blessings for them. And so that could be what it is. If somebody does a favor for you or gives you something that's very helpful, then you can definitely say thank you to them, and you can then pray for God to bless them. You can pray for things to go their way. And you've probably seen it or perhaps even done it. You know, a big group of people get together and everybody brings something to eat, and maybe one of the ladies leaves a dish there, and the hostess will clean it up, wash it, and return it. And rather than just returning it all dirty with whatever's left over, or, you know, sometimes they might bake something, bake some cookies and return the Tupperware container with cookies in it. It's something where when someone does something nice for you, you have all sorts of options in how you can pay it back and return the favor. And if you think about a society or a culture where that is really practiced, you'd have this flurry of generosity. You'd have this situation where everyone would be taking care of everyone else. It would just constantly be people giving to each other, thinking about others, and it takes all of the focus off of being self-centered. And what does that sound like if you picture a society like that? It sounds like the kingdom. It sounds like the way that everyone would live if we all followed God's way of give and love. We were talking about being self-indulgent this week and how we need to make sure that we aren't getting so concentrated on the things that we want, on the things that we want to have or want to do, that we forget about other people and doing things for them sometimes. If you are really thankful and you're trying to think about how you can return a favor, it's going to take that focus off of self, and it's going to make it so that there is this attitude and this generosity that's just going everywhere. So the final one, point four, is related to that, but a little different. There was a movie in 2000 that came out. It was called Pay It Forward. And the idea of the movie Pay It Forward was that when something happens to you, something good, rather than paying it back, you pay it forward. The way that it went in the movie is that if something good happened to you, you did three good things for other people. And, you know, you kind of shared the blessing with others. And I was thinking about this because if you think about paying it back or returning the favor, we can never pay God back for what he's done. We can never go and do anything that's anywhere near the things that God has done for us. But when we get a blessing from God, what can we do? Well, we can share that blessing. We can share it with others. We were blessed this year with a piece of property, and we love to have people over there, and we love to share it and be able to have fun and get out there and run around and play with the horses and, you know, shoot at targets and just be able to enjoy it. We like to do that with other people. And there are all sorts of blessings that you get that you can then turn around and you can share. Let's turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 9. 2 Corinthians 9. This is another verse where Paul is talking about a gift and thankfulness and prayer. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 8. God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you always, having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. And then down in verse 11, being enriched in everything to all bountifulness, which causes through us thanksgiving to God. So here it's talking about when we are giving gifts, when we are getting gifts, we should have this thankfulness to God, ultimately. Verse 12, for the administration of this service not only supplies the want of the saints, but is abundant also by many thanksgivings unto God. And kind of what Paul is saying here is that being able to be generous within the church, to help other church people out or give gifts within the church, not only does it help the needs of those church members, but it results in this thankful attitude within the church. You have an attitude, again, it's an unselfish attitude. It's a thankful attitude where people are going to God and they're giving thanks and they're giving prayer. If someone gives you a gift and you're thankful and it drives you to pray, that's a benefit, not just for you and for the person who gave you the gift, but if as a church, as a whole, there's an abundance of many thanksgivings unto God, as Paul says, if we are all praying, if we're all in this thankful attitude, that's going to be good for everyone. It's going to be good for all of us and for the work and for the church as a whole. So again, that's the first way that you can pay it forward. You can pray, you can be thankful, and you can ask for blessings for the whole church, for everyone involved in God's work and for the work as a whole. Another way that we are able to pay it forward, to share our blessings, is through the work. If you think about what the best gift that we have as Christians, it's the knowledge of God's way of life. It's the knowledge of the true gospel and what the future is for humanity. So when we are doing this, we're thinking about sharing our blessings, the commission to preach the gospel is definitely part of this. We need to preach the gospel, the way of abundant living, the way to happy families. We heard about the response from the broadcast, the lady who would like to know more about having a happy family. We can live a life that sets an example for others. All of these kinds of things are ways that we can spread the blessings that we've received and be able to make sure that others are partaking of them. When we went to China, the first thing that we did the morning after we got there was we drove out to a place called Mutianyu, where there's a section of the Great Wall. And it was really amazing to go see that. Again, you know, the scale of it is incredible. The Great Wall was built on top of a bunch of territorial walls that separated these different kind of states before China was a unified empire. And after it was unified, then they started to turn it into this defensive wall. It used to just kind of be a border marker. And then especially the Ming Dynasty in the Middle Ages, kind of medieval times, really built the wall as it is now, where it's tall and wide and a true defensive fortification. But if you add up the main wall and the spurs, it's about 5,100 miles long. So 5,100 miles of wall that they built. And one of the things that was most impressive about it is it's built on top of the highest ridge wherever it goes. You know, it was meant to be a defensive fortification. And so it's not just built on a flat area. It's a 20, 30-foot wall that's 10 to 30 feet wide, built on top of mountains and cliffs. And when you get up on top of it, you have a great view of all of the surrounding areas. You can see how if you stood up there and were placed on guard, it would be a pretty effective defensive measure. But when you think about the length of that, 5,100 miles, the U.S.-Canadian border is 5,500 miles long, but that includes 1,500 miles along Alaska. So if you take the top of the continental U.S., the Great Wall would be more than enough to stretch that entire distance and create a wall all the way between the continental U.S. and Canada. It's really pretty amazing. But when we went out there, it was in a different part of the area than Beijing. Beijing, big city, lots of cars, lots of pollution. Mutianyu is about an hour and a half out, and it's in farm country. And it was really beautiful. There were mountains, and there were trees, and there was farmland, and rivers and creeks and streams. Very beautiful. And there were actually a couple of hotels and resort areas that were reserved for the use of the leadership of the Communist Party. And at one point, we came around a corner in a road, and where the road went straight, there was this big, imposing white gate. It looked kind of like the Brandenburg Gate. It was large, concrete and stone, and it had a gate across the road, had a guardhouse, had a couple of military guards standing in place. So we asked the driver, we said, "What's that?" And he said, "Oh, party golf course." It was a golf course for the Communist Party, for the leadership of the Communist Party. And we said, "Oh, well, who can play there?" And he said, "Oh, not very many people, and it's very expensive." And he asked if we played golf, and one of the guys that was there from work, he golfed, and he said, "Oh, yeah, you know, I play sometime." And he goes, "You must be very wealthy." And he said that to play golf over there, the cost for going and playing a round of golf can be about half of a year's wage for what would be an average worker. And there's a huge disparity. But our driver, he loved the area that we were in around Mutianyu because he was out of the city. He was born and raised in Beijing and had lived there all his life. And he was probably in his 50s. And he loved this area that was farmland. And he said, there's no pollution and it's beautiful. And he said his dream was to retire there one day. And he showed us these farmhouses and he said he'd like to own one of those. But he said he can't because he has a residence card and he can only buy property in central Beijing. So he could go out there and he could rent, but he can't actually buy a piece of property out there. It's just restricted to where he can be and what he can do. And so he is unable to live the lifestyle that we live and to do the things that we do over here. So we should make sure that we take advantage of that to spread the gospel, to spread the knowledge that we have, and to share the blessings that we have far and wide. There are a couple of places over in Psalms. We'll just turn to one of them. Let's turn to Psalms 107. Psalms 107. In verse 21, Psalms 107, verse 21, "Oh, that men would praise their God for his goodness and for his wonderful works to the children of men, and let them sacrifice the sacrifices of thanksgiving and declare his works with rejoicing." There are a couple of other places where the sacrifices of thanksgiving are mentioned. And if you look over in Leviticus 7, verses 12 to 15, we won't turn there, but if you go read there, you'll see that there was a sacrifice of thanksgiving that was defined, and it was an offering that you could give. Have we ever given an offering of thanksgiving? Have we ever been very thankful about something that has been in our life, and then it's led us to give an extra offering of thanksgiving? It could be a monetary offering to the church to help out with the work. But over in Hebrews chapter 13, Paul talks about a sacrifice of thanksgiving. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 15. Hebrews 13:15, "By him, therefore, let us offer the sacrifice of praise to God continually, that is, the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name." So here it says that the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name, is a sacrifice of praise. "But to do good and to communicate, forget not, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased." So again, prayer can be a great way to continue to share the blessings that we've received. We are extremely blessed to be alive, to be living in the safety, the freedom, the abundance that we enjoy, to be able to hear and understand and practice God's truth, to know about this way of life that leads to real happiness, to be part of the work, to be able to have Bibles, to have our families, on and on and on. So many things that we're blessed with. And being truly thankful is a completely positive act. There's no complaining, there's no unhappiness, there's no griping. It's one of those few truly positive things that exist here in the world, and definitely it's a Christian attitude that we should have and we should express. Let's turn over to 1 Thessalonians in closing. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 18. "In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God and Christ Jesus concerning you." So it's God's will that we show appreciation, that we give thanks, that we express our gratitude. And as it says here, in everything, elsewhere it says in all things, or always give thanks. No matter what kind of situation we're in, there's something that we can find to be thankful about it. And that's what we're commanded to do here. We need to find the ways to show appreciation. And it shouldn't be hard for us to think of things that we're thankful for, because we all definitely have a lot to be thankful for. So let's take advantage of these opportunities and let's express our gratitude in as many ways as we can.